Welcome to another deep dive with us. Today we're going to be looking at a book. It's called Strategie de Groupe, and it was written back in 1990.
Okay.
Now, I know what you might be thinking, 1990. That's ancient history in the business world.
Yeah.
But
things move so fast.
Yeah, things move so fast. But actually, we're going to be looking at how a lot of the stuff that's in this book is actually still relevant to today. You know, we're talking about things like acquisitions, market domination, you know, how do companies become these big powerhouses? So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how some of this old wisdom still applies today.
Yeah. And what's cool about this book is it doesn't just talk about theory. It's really grounded in real world examples. And a lot of them come from the author's own company, A.L. Tiro. So we kind of get this behind the scenes look at how these concepts actually play out in practice.
Right. Like, how do they actually implement this stuff?
Exactly.
That's cool. Okay. Well, the book starts off with this really interesting anecdote. Have you heard the story about the wheat and the chessboard?
Oh, yeah. It's a classic.
Yeah.
Really highlights the power of compounding, which people often underestimate.
Okay. So for anyone who hasn't heard it, there's a king. And he's just been introduced to the game of chess.
Right.
And he's so impressed, he wants to reward the inventor.
Of course, yeah.
So he's like, ask for anything you want.
Any reward.
Yeah.
And the inventor's request seems really simple at first. Just one grain of wheat.
Okay.
On the first square of the chessboard.
Okay.
But then it doubles on each subsequent square.
Okay, so like 1, 2, 4, 8, 16.
Exactly.
Okay.
Seems reasonable enough, right?
I mean, who would say no to a little wheat?
Right. Who could imagine where that's going to end up?
Right.
That's the point. So the king, not exactly a math whiz, he agrees without really thinking it through. And as they go through the chessboard, the numbers just explode. By the time they hit that final square.
64.
Yeah. The total amount of wheat is astronomical.
Like, how much are we talking?
Well, according to the story, enough to cover all the Earth's fields, like 76 times over.
Wow. Okay. So that escalated quickly.
It really did.
Yeah.
It's this perfect illustration of how even small, consistent gains, when compounded over time, can lead to massive, massive results.
Right. So the book uses this story as an analogy for business growth. You know, what might seem like small gains early on.
Yeah.
Can actually snowball into huge success if you're patient and you're consistent.
Exactly. And that leads us to the core of why companies often form groups in the first place. The pursuit of power and influence.
Okay, so it's like that single grain of wheat on the chessboard. But instead of wheat, we're talking about companies joining forces. And it's not just about, you know, friendly collaboration. We're talking about strategic alliances, right?
Yeah.
To gain leverage in the market.
Absolutely, yeah. The book argues that groups, they wield much more power than any single company could on its own. They have more say with suppliers, they can access larger pools of capital, they can even influence government policies.
It's kind of like that saying, strength in numbers, but applied to the business world.
Right, but with much higher stakes.
Yeah, for sure. So does the book give any real-world examples of this?
It does, yeah. There's a great case study about Saint-Gobain, the French glass manufacturer.
Okay.
And they basically built up this, I guess you could call it a war chest of cash through some clever financial maneuvering.
So they were getting their finances in order, ready to pounce when the opportunity arose.
Exactly. And this financial cushion, it gave them the freedom to make strategic acquisitions when they needed to.
I see. So they were biding their time, building up their resources so they could seize the right moment.
Precisely. And that's how they ultimately became a leader in their industry.
Okay. So they were playing the long game.
Mm.
I like it. So let's talk about how these groups actually go about expanding their empires. What kind of growth strategies are we talking about here?
Well, the book outlines two main approaches, organic and external growth.
Okay. So break that down for me.
Organic growth is all about internal development, creating new products, expanding into new markets, that sort of thing.
Right, like building from within.
Exactly.
And then external growth.
That's where acquisitions come in, buying up existing companies to expand your reach.
So it's the classic build versus buy dilemma. Do you invest the time and resources to develop something new, or do you just go out and buy a company that already has what you need?
Right. And there are pros and cons to both. The book goes into detail about the trade-offs between concentration, you know, focusing on your core business.
Sticking to your knitting.
Yeah, exactly. And diversification, which means branching out into new unrelated areas.
Spreading your bets.
Yeah. It all comes down to risk versus reward.
Right. Do you stick with what you know and try to dominate that space? Or do you try to diversify and potentially mitigate risk.
Precisely. And for companies like AL Trade, the author's own company, the answer was often found in acquisitions.
Really? They favored that approach.
They did, yeah.
Okay, so I'm curious, why the emphasis on acquisitions? What advantages do they see in that strategy?
Well, the book argues that acquisitions, while they can be tricky, can be the fastest way to achieve market dominance. Instead of starting from scratch, you're getting a company that already has infrastructure, customers, expertise. It's like you're skipping a few levels in a video game.
Oh, I like that analogy. So they saw it as a way to accelerate their growth and kind of leapfrog the competition.
Exactly. But of course, it's not as simple as just writing a check. Acquiring a company is a whole process. It involves due diligence, negotiations, and then ultimately integrating two different entities. The book uses a real example to illustrate this, AL Trad's acquisition of Mefran, a scaffolding manufacturer.
Okay, so this is where the rubber meets the road, a real-life case study. Tell me about this Mefran acquisition. Where did they even begin?
Well, they started with what the book calls the pre-diagnostic phase. Think of it like getting a home inspection before you buy a house. They looked at Mefran's financials, evaluated their market position, even analyzed their organizational structure.
They were really doing their homework.
Oh, absolutely. They wanted to know everything about Mefran, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And then, based on what they found, they moved into the restructuring phase. This is where they made changes to streamline operations, revamped the sales force, improved administrative processes.
So they saw potential in Mefran, but they knew it needed some work. It makes you wonder, why was Mefran even an acquisition target in the first place? Were they struggling? Or was AL Trade just seeing an opportunity that no one else did?
That's a great question, and it gets to the heart of why mergers and acquisitions happen. Sometimes a company might have all the right ingredients, but they're just not being utilized effectively.
Like a great recipe with the wrong chef.
Exactly. AL Trade had a knack for identifying these hidden gems and then applying their expertise to turn things around. It's pretty impressive.
Okay, so they spot this diamond in the rough, they do their due diligence, they restructure. But how do you even determine what a company's worth? I mean, especially if you're anticipating a restructuring phase. Clearly, you're seeing something beyond just the numbers on a balance sheet.
That's a key point, and this is where the book introduces the concept of static versus dynamic valuation. Static valuation is pretty straightforward. You look at a company's assets, you look at their liabilities, and you get a snapshot of their worth at that moment in time.
Okay.
But dynamic valuation, that's where it gets more interesting. Hmm. It takes into account the future potential of the company. Factors like brand reputation, customer loyalty, growth opportunities, all those intangible things that can be hard to quantify, but they can make a huge difference in the long run.
So you're not just looking at what a company is today, you're also looking at what it could become.
Exactly.
I can see why that would be so important for a company like AL Trade, since they were known for their ability to revitalize businesses.
Right. They were masters of spotting untapped potential. And the book has this great anecdote about this very thing. The CEO of Schneider Electric, he was asked why he was willing to pay what seemed like an insanely high price for an electrical equipment manufacturer called Telemecanique.
Okay, so what was his reasoning?
He said, "I reason in terms of 15 years.
Wow.
He was thinking long term, factoring in the growth potential that others might have missed.
But he was willing to play the long game, even if it meant making a bold move in the present.
Exactly. And that takes us to the financial tactics that groups like AL Trade employed, both for making acquisitions and for managing their cash flow internally.
Okay, so let's talk money. What strategies were they using to fund these acquisitions and keep everything running smoothly within the group?
Well, one key concept the book delves into is financial leverage. It's all about amplifying returns by using borrowed money.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Give me an example.
Sure. Imagine a company wants to make a $5 million investment. They're hoping to see a return of, say, $8 million in the first year.
Mm.
Right? So they're anticipating a healthy profit, but there's always risk involved, especially with a large investment.
Of course, yeah. No guarantees in the business world.
Right. That's where the idea of leverage comes in. Using borrowed money to potentially magnify those returns. But of course, as you said, it also increases the risk.
So how does leverage actually work in this example? Walk me through it.
Okay, so instead of funding the whole $5 million investment with their own money, the company decides to borrow half of it, $2.5 million.
Okay.
Now, they'll have to pay interest on that loan, of course, which will eat into their profits, but...
But they only had to put up half the capital to begin with. It's like they're controlling a bigger asset with less of their own money up front. I get the appeal.
Exactly. Think of it like a lever, you know? You apply a small force to one end, and it can move a much larger weight on the other. But of course, there's always the risk that the lever could break,
Right.
and then the consequences are magnified.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. You can boost your returns, but
Yeah.
you're also increasing the potential for losses. It's a high risk, high reward kind of game.
Precisely. And the book, it emphasizes that companies need to be careful not to become too reliant on debt. It can leave them vulnerable, especially if the market takes a downturn.
Makes sense. You don't want to be overextended if things take an unexpected turn.
Exactly. Now, shifting gears a little bit, let's talk about another interesting financial tactic the book mentions, the centralized treasury.
Okay, I'm all ears.
It's basically a way to manage cash flow efficiently within a group of companies, making sure funds are being used strategically across the board.
So instead of each subsidiary handling its own finances independently, there's like a central hub controlling the flow of money.
Right, like an internal bank for the group.
I like that internal bank.
Yeah.
So how does that work in practice?
Imagine a group with multiple subsidiaries, each operating in different markets or industries. Some might be generating tons of cash, while others might be struggling.
Sure, some are saving their allowance, some are always borrowing.
Exactly. The centralized treasury, usually managed by the holding company, can step in and act as a bank for the entire group. It pools the surplus cash from the profitable subsidiaries and then lends it to those who need it.
Oh, I see. So instead of those struggling subsidiaries having to go out and get external financing, which can be expensive, they can borrow internally at potentially better rates.
Exactly. It often leads to lower borrowing costs for the group as a whole because they can negotiate better terms with lenders.
Makes sense. They're a more attractive borrower as a collective, a bigger fish.
Right. But the book does acknowledge that this system can create tension. You can imagine how the profitable subsidiaries might feel about their hard-earned cash being used to prop up the less successful ones.
Yeah, I can definitely see that leading to some friction. So, how do you address that?
Transparency and communication are key. The holding company needs to clearly demonstrate how the centralized treasury ultimately benefits the entire group. It helps ensure stability, it allows for strategic investments, and in the long run, it makes the collective stronger.
It's about building trust and reminding everyone that they're part of the same team. Even if their financial performance might fluctuate, they're all working toward a shared goal.
Exactly. Now, this brings us to a really crucial point that the book emphasizes and something we touched on earlier, the human element.
Right, behind all these strategies, all the financial maneuvering, we can't forget that it's people who are actually driving everything forward.
Absolutely. And the book argues that successful groups understand this. They build a culture of delegation and empowerment. They trust their leaders, give them the authority to make decisions, and hold them accountable for the results.
It's about encouraging ownership and responsibility at every level, not just having a top-down micromanagement approach.
Exactly. And when you do that, when you create a culture of trust and empowerment, it unlocks people's creativity and initiative. Decisions get made faster, employees are more engaged, everyone wins.
And on the flip side, I imagine that a top-down approach can actually stifle innovation. You know,
Yeah.
no one wants to feel like just a cog in the machine.
You got it. People want to feel valued, they want to contribute. The book really stresses the importance of clear communication and mutual trust between the holding company and its subsidiaries. It's vital that everyone's aligned towards the same goals and feels invested in the overall success of the group.
It all comes back to that idea of building a strong team and recognizing that people are a company's most valuable asset. You can have the best strategies in the world, but without talented and motivated people to execute them, it's all for nothing.
Couldn't agree more. And you know, even in this age of automation and AI, the book makes the case that the human element is still the most crucial factor in any organization's success.
Well said. We've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive. From financial leverage and centralized treasuries to the importance of delegation and empowerment.
Yeah.
And I think one of the key themes that's emerging here is that communication, it seems like that's really the key to making all of this work, whether it's building trust, aligning teams, making sure everyone's moving in the same direction. It all comes down to effective communication.
You nailed it. And actually, Strategy to Group spends a good chunk of time talking about the importance of communication, both internally, within the group, and externally, how the group presents itself to the outside world.
Makes sense, especially for these large groups with multiple companies. Communication can get pretty complicated, right?
Absolutely. Without clear communication, these complex structures can easily become chaotic and inefficient. Imagine trying to conduct an orchestra without a conductor.
Yeah, a bunch of talented musicians all playing different tunes. You'd get a lot of noise, but not much harmony.
Exactly. So the book breaks down communication into two main categories, internal and external. Internal communication is all about how information flows within the group, you know, between the holding company and its subsidiaries, between different departments, even between employees at different levels.
Right. So making sure everyone within the organization is on the same page, they understand the goals, they feel connected to the bigger picture. So what are some of the strategies for effective internal communication?
The book advocates for a transparent and multifaceted approach. Regular meetings, newsletters, company-wide events, even online platforms to facilitate collaboration. The key is to create multiple channels for information to flow freely and to build a culture of open dialogue.
So it's not just about top-down communication from leadership, but also encouraging communication across all levels, making sure that everyone feels comfortable sharing their ideas and perspectives.
Exactly. And the book actually shares an example from AL Tread. They had this monthly newsletter that was distributed to all employees across the entire group.
Oh, interesting. What kind of stuff was in the newsletter?
It highlighted the group's activities, achievements, even challenges they were facing. It helped foster a sense of community and shared purpose.
I like that. It's like a family newsletter, but for a corporate family. Keeps everyone in the loop and creates a sense of belonging.
Exactly. And it can be super effective for larger organizations that are spread out geographically, where people might not have a chance to connect in person all the time.
Makes sense. You need to find creative ways to keep those lines of communication open.
Absolutely. The book also talks about the importance of the CEO communicating directly with employees through letters, town hall meetings, even video messages.
That direct connection with leadership can be so powerful, it makes people feel valued and heard.
Absolutely. Now, flipping to the other side, external communication is all about how the group presents itself to the outside world. This includes everything from PR and advertising to investor relations and community engagement.
So it's about managing the group's public image, building a strong reputation, making sure the world understands their values and vision.
Exactly. And the book dives into a bunch of different tools and strategies for effective external communication. One of the key takeaways is the importance of clear and consistent messaging, no matter what channel you're using. Whether it's a press release, a website, or a social media post, the message should always align with the group's overall identity and goals.
Yeah, consistency is key. You don't want to be sending mixed signals. It's all about building a strong, recognizable brand that people can trust.
Right. And Strategy to Group also makes the point that a group's communication strategy has to evolve as it grows and changes. What worked for a small group might not be effective for a large multinational company.
Makes sense. The challenges become more complex as you expand. You have to figure out how to reach a much wider audience, and the media landscape is constantly changing.
Exactly. And with technology evolving all the time, we're seeing new and innovative ways for companies to connect with their stakeholders. Social media, for instance, has become a really powerful tool for engaging with customers, sharing news, and even managing crises.
It's amazing to think that the core principles of communication outlined in this book, which was written way back in 1990, are still so relevant today, even though the way we communicate has changed dramatically.
It really highlights how important human interaction is, no matter what tools we're using. Whether it's face-to-face, written, or digital, clear, concise, and compelling communication is always going to be crucial.
Well said. This has been a fascinating deep dive into Strategy to Group. We've explored the reasons companies form groups, the strategies they use to grow, the financial tactics they employ, the importance of people, and of course, the critical role of communication.
Yeah, it's been a great discussion. And I think there are some valuable takeaways here that apply not just to massive corporations, but to any organization, big or small.
I completely agree. And as we wrap up this deep dive, it really strikes me that while the business world is constantly changing, the fundamental principles of building a successful organization remain remarkably consistent. Having a clear vision, putting together a talented team, making strategic decisions, and communicating those decisions effectively, both internally and externally, it's timeless wisdom.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And with that, we'll leave you with a question to ponder. Can you think of any companies today that are using similar strategies to what we discussed with ALG? What parallels are you seeing in the business world around you?
We'd love to hear your thoughts. Share them with us on social media using the hashtag, #TheDeepDive. And if you're interested in exploring these ideas further, be sure to check out the full book, Strategy to Group. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.